Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 366th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia, at least at this moment.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. And we have Tony Nikinchuk back in the office. Tony, introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. Tony Nikinchuk, I'm a pharmacist at the hospital in Peace River, Northern Alberta.
And we'll
and not associated with the Trump campaign.
I am not. No.
Any of that Russian
My name
stuff.
Did not come up in the indictment.
Oh, no. on this.
On this indictment. I'm still waiting for the hammer to drop.
And for those of you who remember our previous podcast, we got on to a topic that we actually had not even come close to covering at all before, is the whole concept of social determinants of health. And you know, we sort of looked into the whole issue of how, you know, the key issue of what sort of makes us sick is basically things like income and education and employment and housing, all those sorts of things. And, you know, to a much lesser degree is our healthcare determined by the type of healthcare we have access to, and even less by biology and our environment. So it's really a lot of issues that typically we don't take into account when we're dealing in a, you know, those very short visits that would happen in a healthcare environment. And so so we're going to go on from where we left off, and what are we going to talk about this time?
So I thought I'd dig a little deeper down into sort of Canada-specific data. So, you know, apologies to the individuals not listening from Canada, but the basic concepts of this stuff and how they apply to Canada apply it really fairly closely to a lot of other high-income Western nations. So the sort of relative effects of some of these social determinants, I think, would be pretty much the same in a lot of other high-income nations. A couple of things we'll talk about, they're sort of specific to Canada, but overall, I think you could apply it to most wealthy countries. So Health Canada, Statistics Canada, actually does follow a ton of this stuff in the census cohorts that they get when they do censuses in Canada. And they actually publish a lot of this stuff in a journal called Health Reports. And there's pretty big treasure trove of information in there for issues about social determinants of health. And I came across one cohort that I thought was interesting because it touched on not only you know, income, but it also touched on employment status and it touched on education. So it kind of covered a lot of the bases. The only thing it didn't really cover was housing. And so what this group did is they looked at 2.7 million people and they followed them for more than 10 years. And so that's what you see over and over again in this research, is just these massive cohorts, which does lend some strength to some of the research. So they looked at two things. One was lung cancer incidence, and then they also looked at just overall the age standardized mortality rates. And just to quickly describe what age standardized rates means, essentially they just take different populations that they're comparing and pretend that they have the same age distribution in their population, because obviously younger populations are going to have better health outcomes than older populations. So they just basically remove the effects of age so that they can just look at the issue that they're trying to study. So in the lung cancer incidence, they looked at education, income, and employment status. And what they do in a lot of this research and what they did here was they do these statistical calculations. And basically what they do is, say you have a group with no university degree and maybe some high school, and then you have a group with, you know, high school diploma but no post-secondary, and then you have a group with post-secondary education. You look at the differing rates in these three groups, and then what they do is they do a calculation that basically says, in a perfect world, if everyone had the same incidence of this disease as those with the best outcomes, how many deaths would we prevent, or how many lung cancers would we prevent, right? And so they did that for education, and basically they found that if all Canadians had the same lung cancer incidence as those with university degrees, there'd be 127 fewer cases per 100,000 Canadians. And just a reminder from the last podcast, that's pretty close to the number of deaths attributable to smoking in Canada. So it's not a trivial number. The income number was pretty similar if everyone had the same lung cancer incidence as the wealthiest 20% of Canadians, be about 130 fewer per 100,000. And then when they looked at employment, they looked at like your employment classification. So they looked at, say, sort of like, you know, retail industry, minimum wage jobs, you know, food service industry, and then maybe, you know, manufacturing, some of the higher jobs, some professional jobs. And then they looked at managerial occupations. And those are the occupations that were linked to the highest incomes. And so they chose that. So people with a classification as a managerial occupation had sort of the highest status employment. And if people had the same lung cancer incidence as that high employment status group, there'd be about a little over 200 fewer lung cancers per 100,000. So these impacts weren't insignificant for sure. And then they looked at the age standardized mortality rate. And here they really just looked at education. And basically, not obviously, but as we could kind of predict from what we've already talked about, the mortality rates were the highest among those with the least education and the lowest among those with the most education. And the trend was very distinct. Like every step you went up in education, you had better outcomes, better mortality rates. And if you had the same age standardized mortality rates as the highest education group in Canada, you'd have about 1,000 fewer deaths per 100,000 population.
And one of the cool things with cohort trials is that there's a bunch of rules for, you know, association and causation. And one of the things for causation is there a dose response? Does it, as you get less or more of a particular thing, does the outcome accompany that? And you're saying it absolutely does, which again lends itself to more likely towards causation than if it didn't.
Right. Sure. Those are the rules of causation, right, James, that you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
So then I wanted to talk about a study that I thought was just super interesting. And what they wanted to look at is if inequality in socioeconomic status is costing us as a society as well. And we talk about this a lot, that healthcare resources are scarce. And so we have to be smart about how we divvy them out, so to speak. So this study looked at 55,000 Ontarians, which is a province of Canada. And how likely were they to be a high-cost user of the healthcare system 5 years later? So they looked at them from the start and then followed up 5 years later. And they defined high-cost user as basically the 5% of the population that accounts for 2/3 of our healthcare expenses. And we know these people because we see them the most frequently. Mm-hmm. And they then looked at the factors that were associated with becoming a high-cost user 5 years later. And pretty much all of the social determinants that we've talked about already were linked to that. So low household income versus high, this was an odds ratio, so about 1.3 times more likely to become a high cost user. No post-secondary education versus even just some post-secondary education. So it wasn't even a degree, it was just any post-secondary education. Again, about 1.3 times. Those who are food insecure versus food secure. So they define that as if people respond to a survey question of, in the last month, have you ever been able to unable to afford food that you needed, or did you feel hungry and unable to purchase something to deal with that hunger? It's kind of worded like that. And people that answer yes to those things are ranked as food insecure. And they were about 1.5 times more likely to be high cost users 5 years later. And then interestingly, immigrant Canadians were actually less likely to be high-cost users 5 years later than Canadian-born individuals in this study. So they were about 0.9, and it was statistically significant. It didn't cross one. So that was quite interesting as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating, right? That how much the costs are associated, the long-term costs are associated with the socioeconomic factors are driving a lot of this. Because we just think about that small group that's using up so many healthcare costs, but we don't really think of the nuance of it.
Yeah, and so one thing that comes up again and again when you're looking at this data for Canada specifically, and again, this is the one area that might apply specifically to Canada, but there's always sort of underrepresented groups in countries that are sort of less taken care of, so to speak, and often suffer disproportionate amounts of low socioeconomic status than the say, the majority population. So I think this data would apply to any of those groups in other wealthy countries. And I know in the news a lot lately, there's been a lot of talk about the inequality in the U.S. Between African Americans and white Americans. And so I did look up to compare the inequality in the U.S. on health outcomes and social determinants compared to Canada, because I think in Canada sometimes our assumption is that maybe we're, you know, more equal and we don't have this issue, but we very much do, and in fact Canada's kind of worse in this regards than the U.S. And so the population in Canada that deals with this marginalization the most is First Nations population, and there's massive inequality between non-First Nations in Canada and First Nations Canadians on both social determinants and health outcomes. And in 2015, Canada ranked 10th on the UN Human Development Index, which I might say is down quite a bit from our high point in the 90s when we were consistently in first place. And we're actually tied with the US in 10th in 2015, same Human Development Index as the UN. They've done some studies in the U.S. where they've looked at, if you just pulled out the data for African Americans, where would they rank if they were, say, their own country, so to speak? And that bumps them down to about 40th place. And they end up kind of in the same ballpark as some lower income Eastern European nations. When you do the same thing for First Nations Canadians, it bumps them down all the way to 71st. And so this puts them in the same company as such paragons of development as Venezuela and Cuba and Iran. So these aren't exactly examples of high socioeconomic development that we would hold up to the rest of the world. So I think that's a pretty sobering fact for Canadians to look at, that big gap between First Nations and non-First Nations.
In our own country. I mean, in it's our own a country, huge yeah. wake up, right? To, yeah. I think a lot of us to understand that. How big that difference really is.
Well, and you know, you've heard people talk about the state of infrastructure in some of the reserves in Canada.
Absolutely.
And they refer to them. They say, you know, it's like a third world country. And some people say, that's just, you know, rhetoric and they're trying to make it sound worse than it is. But if you look at the data, they do align with some pretty poor nations across the world. So, and that's in our backyard, essentially, right?
Right, and I know you've been to some of them. I've been to some of them, and I can say that the data that you're talking about supports my experience. And I'm you know, a classic example of most of us. If I visit one of those places, I'm a glimpse. I'm in there for like a day or something like that, and then I'm gone again. It's not even remotely the reality of living in it. So it's this kind of my experience is just this, as I said, a glimpse where if you live there, it would be a whole different context.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Alberta government has done some really good work in looking at a lot of this information and collecting a lot of this data and putting it out there in a really accessible format. You can go to the Alberta First Nations Information Governance Center, and they put out a little one pager every so often called First Nations Health Trends Alberta, and they're just excellent. And it really highlights a lot of the gaps in outcomes for First Nations Albertans compared to non-First Nations. And the number two comes up over and over again when you look at these things, and that is that sort of the rate of poor health outcomes on so many different measures is about double that for First Nations compared to non-First Nations. So the age standardized mortality rate, the infant mortality rate, how often they visit emergency departments, opioid use, diabetes prevalence, like the list just goes on. And I found it interesting, the infant mortality rates among First Nations Albertans are more similar to Uruguay and China than they are to the rest of Canada. So that's puts it in context.
So right.
Yeah. And, you know, there has been a lot reported in the news about the sort of epidemic of suicide in First Nations communities across the country. And the age standardized suicide rates for Alberta First Nations are triple that of non-First Nations. And really tragically, so among women, the rates of death due to assault are 7 times higher than non-First Nations women in Alberta. So those are, I think, some pretty sobering statistics to consider.
Absolutely.
And then just the loss of life too. They look at life expectancy in Alberta. I looked at other provinces as well. The data was the most sort of complete for Alberta. That's why I focused on it, and because, you know, I live here. so I'm a bit Alberta-centric. Yeah. BC's the worst. and the life expectancy here for First Nations in Alberta at birth is about 10 years shorter than that of non-First Nations. And I think one of the most sort of sobering things for me that I came across was that that gap has actually grown over time. So we're not solving this problem as we're going on. It's actually getting worse. So back in the late 90s, the gap was about 7 years. And then the most up-to-date data, actually, the gap is approaching around 12 years, actually. So it's a little more recent than the data I quoted in that previous.
Wow. So do we have any good news?
You know, not much.
That's the, terrible.
We need
some good news. There is some studies showing that we can do some
is.
Things.
Yeah, and I want to just talk about this one really interesting study from the U.S., and this is a super, super fascinating study. This was called the Moving to Opportunity Study, and it was actually done by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, which apparently did do good work at some time. I think Ben Carson now runs it, so maybe not as much. But this was a really interesting study. And what they wanted to see is if kids born in really low-income neighborhoods, if they're given the opportunity to move to a less impoverished neighborhood, does that impact their outcomes as adults? And so they actually took three groups, and it was essentially more or less a randomized trial. It was 4,600 low-income families, and they were living in public housing, so publicly subsidized housing. So these were pretty impoverished individuals. Group one was giving housing vouchers to move to new home, but they had to move to a lower poverty neighborhood. They were told which neighborhood to move to by HUD. Group two was giving housing vouchers, but they were free to use them to move anywhere. And then group three was given nothing. And the results are pretty fascinating. The kids who were moved out of their original neighborhood before age 13, they were more likely to be higher income as adults. They were more likely to attend college, and they were less likely to be single parents as adults. And we know that that itself comes with its own share of challenges. And I guess not surprisingly, the effect of this weakened the longer that the kids stayed in their original neighborhood. And actually past age 13, it had a negative effect on moving them, which makes sense. You're moving them away from their friends and their community and stuff, right? It's very stressful. But I think the most fascinating part of this study was that it was not only like revenue neutral, it was basically revenue like positive. So the cost to Housing and Urban Development to implement this program was about $3,800 per family. The added tax revenue that they got due to the higher earnings that these families experienced because of this intervention was about $22,000 per family. And so it actually like made the government money. Not a lot of interventions in health are even cost effective, let alone actually like cost reductive.
Right.
We don't usually save money. We're usually making a judgment that, okay, well, it costs about $50,000. We're okay with that. Here it actually literally had a net gain. So
I was going to say, even if it didn't, you know, $3,800 per family. I mean, that is not a, that's just like one or two, you know, marginally high expensive drugs.
That's
for one year.
That's half a year of evolocumab.
I was going to use that as the example, but it was a little too easy.
Yeah.
But no, you're right.
See, I took it.
I know you took the low road. But yeah, no, that's the, so even if you don't get this added tax revenue, and you know, there's lots of debates about how whether you can actually do that. I mean, it makes some sense for sure. But yeah, I mean, it's neat to see that if we do these things, but you know, you can just imagine, you know, way more people would be against giving this sort of money per family versus, you know, paying for antidepressants. And it's really unfortunate, but at least it shows that it has an impact.
But these are, I mean, I think that's the way when we see governments making decisions there, and many of us scratch our heads at that, but there is opportunity costs here. And when we talk about opportunity costs, we're saying kind of what Tony and James have talked about. There's only so much money, and we have opportunity of all sorts of opportunities to do something with that money. But when you choose one, like fixing roads, you're actually choosing not to invest in education,
yeah.
or you're choosing not to put more money into. And if we continue to pour more money into healthcare, we're choosing not to make better housing and provide better education opportunities for people. And so, and that actually has more of an impact on their health.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that really struck me with this is I see now a lot of communities and urban planning is around the idea of offering building expensive neighborhoods or more expensive neighborhoods, and then within them building lower cost housing and actually supported housing where people can, who are struggling kind of to make ends meet, can get moved. And many people in those neighborhoods resist that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is exactly where the idea comes from. So in your communities, if you're lucky enough to live in wealthier communities and you wonder why are they moving poor people in here, it's exactly this kind of study that Tony presented. There's also research about moving people away who, let's say, have some histories of addictions or what have you, and or violence, and moving them out of those environments so they can get separated from it and get a cleaner and easier break. All of these things play a part. And so, you know, when you're in your community and you're feeling like, why are, and I'm going to put in quotations, these people moving into my neighborhood, remember, this is, you're not having to do really anything, and you're actually drastically improving the future opportunities for particularly the children in these families.
Yeah, absolutely. And just kind of springing off that really quickly, before I get into some of the things that, you know, individual health practitioners can do, there have been studies done on this, and one was done in Canada, and they looked at the difference in expenses in provinces and how that played in terms of the health outcomes in those provinces. And probably the biggest takeaway from this was that just total government expenditure didn't seem to have much impact. And so just throwing more money at the problem doesn't necessarily solve it. What did have a positive impact was four areas specifically. One was medical care, and that actually didn't include hospitals. That included primary care, outpatient care, dental, drug coverage, those sorts of things. Preventive care, which the majority of that was immunizations. Other social services, so particularly for those in need, but also included, say, temporary unemployment assistance. And then post-secondary education was a big one that made a difference in health outcomes. And so that's just that idea that we need to be smart about where we put our money. And overall, when they look at the international picture too, it's not health spending that has the most significant impact on outcomes, it's actually social spending. And so a lot of countries have been sort of slowly trying to push more money towards social programs and trying to grow health spending more slowly in hopes that that will improve outcomes.
And now, Tony, you work for the provincial government. I do too, but I have a middleman that protects me from them. So you work more directly for them. So I'm not going to ask you to answer the question of as why would the Ministry of Health decide to build large buildings where we do more in-hospital treatments, like let's say the Mazankowski here, versus actually investing in prime. I'm not going to ask you that question because I know your job's in jeopardy. But it seems interesting that as many governments resist this clear findings in research that we should be spending at a community level much more, whether it's social programs or within medicine or what have you, rather than these kind of they're like the Great Pyramid of Giza and that kind of thing. That's what governments seem to want to spend money on. Yeah. And I'm not gonna put you on the spot. James, comments?
Yeah, I think one, you're biased. Two, no. But in this case, I think that, you know, there's a truth to it. You know, you probably get more, you know, publicity and press by, you know, building something bigger and better and having it, you know, be the tallest building in, you know, downtown Vancouver and all that sort of stuff. Whereas, you know, those are tend to be subtly more exciting, if you will. I'm not sure why, though. But whereas, you know, sort of helping people and getting them to deal with many of these social determinants of health is not as sexy. And I think it literally is that.
I think so too. And I was kind of bugging Tony a bit, but because of his job, but I agree with you 100%. I think that we're, as a government, you want to see your money. It's like, why are we not investing? Why are we talking about the backlog in emergency departments when it's really a backlog in hospital beds that are leading to this problem? And the backlog in hospital beds is not, it's not a hospital problem. It's a long-term care problem.
Yeah.
And yet we focus on those two front-end pieces rather than dealing with the back-end piece, which isn't generally as sexy, building long-term care facilities and supporting people in their homes more.
Yeah, I'll just make two quick points, and neither of which I think put my job in jeopardy. one is that, in fairness, politicians love nothing more than a photo op with a hard hat and a shovel. And so... Like, you see those pictures all the time. And if there's a ribbon thrown in there that they can cut, it's just better. That's dynamite, like the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
And it makes sense in a sense. That's a really quick, easy message to send that, you know, we're making progress and we're breaking ground and we're building actual bricks and mortar, right? The other thing is, too, that I've often said before when discussing the Canadian health system with people is we do a pretty good job of acute care in Canada. Mm-hmm. We've got that kind of figured out for the most part. What we don't have figured out well is primary care, prevention, and then the other end of the spectrum, the long-term care.
Yeah.
And that, but that feeds into all the other problems in our system.
Agreed.
So just so people don't think I'm just a big Grinch and a big bummer on this whole topic, there definitely is some research out there about what can be done, even on an individual clinic level. And I really encourage people to read the CMAG December 6, 2016 issue. There was a great sort of longer piece in there called Taking Action on the Social Determinants of Health. It was really good. It had a lot of great ideas for family physicians, especially in terms of how they can approach social determinants of health and work it into their regular clinic visits. And they talked about the idea of social diagnoses. And one reason being that if you diagnose some of the problems that, you know, led your patient to come see you, it may avoid some inappropriate investigations and you may sort of realize what the problem is without having to dig a little deeper. And there was one stat in that article that I just found so like upsetting. They sort of audited some practices, and even when women presented to their care provider with bruises and broken bones, only 14% of them were asked about violence in the home. And you think that would be kind of one of the first things that would pop to mind. But I think sometimes there's a stigma around it, right? And, that's private information. And
right.
Like, you're their doctor. You ask them private information all the time, right?
Yeah.
So I think we need to get rid of some of that stigma and be okay with asking it. And the author does talk about some tools to sort of work social inquiry into your patient encounter. And she includes in there some questions that have like actually been validated to be sensitive in identifying individuals with, say, poverty issues or food security issues. So I really recommend taking a look at that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of push now within medicine. So, for example, the National College, the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and a number of the provincial colleges. I think Ontario led the way here, but Alberta is joining in too. And that is the poverty screening tool. And it's the question that you indicated from that article in helping identify those who are having trouble. And that question is, do you ever have difficulty making ends meet at the end of the month? I think that is a relatively simple tool to use. And you can actually just Google poverty tool, College of Family Physicians or something like that, and you will come up with some of them. And there's ones made for each province in Canada.
So she did talk about a few of the studies that have shown interventions that have sort of shown promising outcomes in this area. And it basically, the idea is that once you have a social diagnosis, there's also nothing wrong with social prescribing, so to speak. And what that is basically connecting patients with the pertinent community resources for the issue that they're dealing with. And so there was this cluster randomized controlled trial of 8 community health centers in Boston. And during well child visits, so something that was already being done, they just worked in a process of systematically screening individuals for locally relevant social needs. And then they sort of tied that back to the physicians as well. And they gave the physicians in the clinics that were involved just a simple one pager of local resources and what those resources were for. Because docs don't have a ton of time. And so it needs to be a simple cross reference. Oh, you're dealing with, you know, poverty, for example, I can link you to these guys. And then the contact information for that. And it increased some pretty good outcomes. It increased family enrollment in support services, which was kind of the point. And then, but it also increased maternal employment, which I think was really positive. It increased access of families to childcare, and it even decreased homelessness at 1 year, which is obviously not an insignificant outcome.
These are huge outcomes, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, homelessness is, you know, the worst of the worst in terms of, say, housing status and income and everything. And the health outcomes in the homeless population are just awful. Like, they're so far below the general population.
So, Mike, are you saying that these outcomes are more important than A1Cs?
Not only are they more important, James, but I would hazard to guess that most patients themselves would put higher priority on them. And many of us who struggle understanding why our patients are not addressing their A1C, we might want to look a little deeper as to some larger issues that are affecting
their ability. I'm saying it tongue in cheek, but it's
so, I know you are.
Yeah,
it's so like I said, this issue of sort of the social diagnosis and social prescribing, it's you know, we're so used to sort of, not used to, but the sort of the pill for every ill. When this really just intuitively makes much more common sense. Just the title of one of your slides is "It Takes a Village," and you know, these that's been known for thousands of years.
Yeah,
you know, but we lose that with some of what we do in society today.
Well, and the other thing too, if you work with any of these folks that work in some of these social support services, they talk about how, like, they get, you know, in a lot of cases, they don't get as many referrals as they would think, and they get underutilized to an extent, right? So they want to be involved and want to help. We just need to point our patients in the right direction. And the last study I'll talk about is a really neat study that was done in San Antonio. And it was, I believe, just one clinic, but they were centered in a sort of low-income, highly Hispanic population in that city. And what their hypothesis was if we enhance the well-being of the community, that will sort of enhance our patients' well-being as well. So, you know, a rising tide raises all boats. And they hired these outreach workers to work for the clinic, and they interacted with their patients in their communities and a lot of times in their first language, Spanish, and then connected them with social supports that were relevant to them, but then also fed back, you know, the interview and what social supports they were connected to and how that went. And they fed all that back into the clinic. So when the patients came into the clinic, the doc or the nurse, whoever was assessing them, had that information, you know, at the ready, and they could access it as part of their important background. And so in the zip code studied, and just keep in mind, this is just one community in one city in the United States, they had a 25% decrease in hospitalizations, a little over 10% decrease in ER visits, and they saved about $250,000, which is pretty impressive given it was just, you know, one isolated community.
And they hired people. So they had an expense on one
side.
That's right.
Yeah, it, you know, was net of the cost for hiring these individuals. And I was talking to someone this week who works in a PCN, and she said, you know, we've done a lot of work about getting other health providers and PCNs, pharmacists, nurse practitioners, dietitians sometimes, and they're like, no one talks about social workers. And like, why aren't we talking about that? And they're so underutilized, and I think they could, like, make such a valuable contribution to health teams.
Yeah, we do that in the clinic that I work in. One of the first things actually that we all talked about is the need for that. We work in lower socioeconomic status area, and we originally, the clinic was designed to target those kind of patients. They had to account for at least 50% of our practice. And the social worker was key for us. And, you know, we joked a little bit earlier about how so many things that are in a patient's life can get in the way of what we consider optimized care. But we found that just adding the social worker could make huge impacts in paying for their medicines, getting access to their medicines, even driving to getting support. We would provide taxi receipts to get to and from the clinic and all sorts of things, because it just became very clear to us that the barriers to their care were not around the medical office. They were so much broader than that. And until we address those, we weren't really going to make much headway.
Yeah, and I work at a hospital now, and I had no idea before I started working in a hospital just how much of the patient's care when they're in acute care while they're staying there is done by the social worker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dealing with challenges they have financially, or, you know, where they're going to live after, anything like that. And I don't think any of our other patients would be, you know, all that much different in terms of the prevalence of that need. So I think that's one thing for us to look at. Just some other quick ideas, you know, hiring dedicated support service navigators, so people that work in the clinic to sort of hook people up with the right support services, building partnerships with the folks who do this sort of stuff, so public health organizations. And then I think what's really important too is physicians do have a leadership role in their communities and other health professionals as well, and just using your voice to speak about the health impacts of social challenges and you know, working with your leaders as well and your political leaders and trying to influence public policy as much as you can, you know, being one individual in a larger population. So I think all of that goes together.
For sure. James, any insights?
Yeah, no. I mean, like I said, this is it shows how important this area is. And again, it's like anything else. There's no easy solution. But I think the key thing where you said other ways to make a difference, it is about us speaking out about it. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about things like, you know, we haven't even actually covered on, you know, universal health care and, you know, universal pharmacare and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I've done a fair amount of reading recently on stuff about whether or not, you know, universal health care is really a basic human. Is it a right for us to have universal mm-hmm. healthcare? And we just have to stop arguing about it. I mean, you can argue it, whether or not it's a right or not, but who cares? It's the right thing to do.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, it's really, you know, what many people sort of call is, it's just an essential service. It's like education, clean water, air, protection from crime, which we all agree are pretty much essential services. So, you know, we need to get off the pot about these issues about whether the, you know, it's a right or it's not a right and blah blah blah. Most of these things that we're talking about are the right thing to do, and you know, yeah. In this case, in contrast to much of what we've talked about on the other 365 podcasts, well, 364 actually, is that yeah. You know, a lot of these things are, there's actual savings associated with them, and yeah. The issue is they're just not nearly as sexy, not marketed as well, and so on. So, you know, the reason that we decided to do these podcasts, one is that Tony did such a great job of putting everything together, and clearly, Mike, in hearing what he had to say, it tweaked something in you to say this is sort of an important message to get out. And you know, we are, you know, maybe we're saying it's so important because we don't pay much attention to it on a very regular basis, and clearly there's probably millions of people who do this every day, and they're fully aware of all this. But we just thought that there is a fair amount, there's lots of evidence around this, not just for identifying the problem, but the solutions to the problem. And so that's kind of why we did why we have done this. And like I said, Tony, super job on it. And I don't really have anything else to say, Mike.
No, just it struck me. I've always been interested in this kind of thing and healthcare costs, and all that. Those were some of the first research studies I did in medicine. And then as time went on, I ended up becoming a teacher of what was called community medicine here at U of A, running the undergrad course. And a huge part of it was public health and the social determinants. And I actually had for the whole med school, I bought enough board games that we could play in small groups, the board game, The Last Straw, because I really thought it was so important for students to start to understand what it's like for many other patients. They'll see some of it, but actually the game kind of wakes you up to that a little bit earlier. And gradually over time, we in the peer group and the Tools for Practice group have wondered about how we can start to deal with some of these issues. We decided to add it into Pipe this year, which turned out to be a dynamite idea. And once I saw Tony, what a great job he did, I wanted him to come on and talk about it a little bit, just so that our listeners can also begin to just be reinvigorated about the importance of this in the care of their patients and how it plays such a huge part in their overall well-being.
When you said there was a board game, I just assume you were talking about the game of life. board game.
I was actually waiting for him to say that.
No, no, no. It's a little bit better than that. No, it's called The Last Straw, for those of you who didn't hear the first.
Yeah. Although even with the Game of Life, there's some subtle nuances there as well, but so, not nearly to the degree of game one that you're talking about.
Oh, it's quite shocking how quickly things fall apart for you when you've when your socioeconomic status and challenges that are presented by different culture, race, all those kind of things. Yeah.
So great stuff. So thanks to both of you guys actually for doing sort of working this into our podcast. Like I say, it's subtly different than other stuff that we've done, but hopefully some of the messages and the evidence are tweaking other people to think in different ways. I mean, that's basically why we do this podcast, is because we want you guys to think in different ways, and 95% of the time we hope that's better.
Good. Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, so yeah,
thanks for inviting me, guys.
Oh yeah, no, more than welcome, Tony. That was great stuff. And you know, like you said, it doesn't take long to just delve into it and you go, my goodness, what a wonderful sort of rich evidence base that we have for this. So not a whole lot to sell, I don't think, although I feel I really shouldn't even try to sell anything because it's so, you know, immaterial, or so material.
Yeah.
And but we would love it if you would continue to let people know about our podcast, let people know on iTunes about the podcast. Feel free to send us questions. Go look at our website, therapeuticseducation.org, for all of the work that we're doing there, and also go to Tools for Practice. And any tools for practice on social determinants of health? Maybe.
We just did one on safe injection sites, which is not exactly the same, but related to,
yeah, sort of relates to
some
it.
Of these issues. Yeah.
Cool.
And
So check that out. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.